Good morning again. Can you hear me all right? Great. So today's reflection is on non-self, as you know. And there are a number of ways to do it. Really look at who do we think we are? Not who do you think you are? But this really is a good question. and what we think we have, what we think is ours. The Buddha did this in different ways, and two different ways in particular. He would talk about the five khandhas in terms of, are these permanent or impermanent? You know, you look at the body, obviously it's not permanent. The signs of deterioration are readily available for experiencing. And then he would ask, so if something's impermanent, is it suffering or not suffering? Suffering or happiness? And the answer that his audience would always give is it's suffering. Because after all, when something doesn't last, if we want it to last, or we want it to come back, or whatever, we are experiencing dukkha. And then the question, well, if something is impermanent and suffering, then how could it be a self, or is it a self? Is it self? And the idea is that there's no abiding self, you know. We take this to be us, but we can't rely on it. It doesn't have anything, really substantial behind it. So that's true of the body. The Buddha compared the body to foam. If you ever see foam at the side of the, like, out in the bay, you know, you see some foam gathering, or in a creek sometime on the edge. And the body's like that. It might look like it's something from a distance, but you get close up or you see it kind of wash away. And then the next thing to examine in the five khandhas is feeling. And we know for sure that feeling isn't permanent. It comes and goes so quickly. And it's often suffering. You know, even if it's a good feeling, and we want it to stay around longer than it does, it's not reliable. And it's not us, but oftentimes we feel like that's what we are in the moment. And our language doesn't help. I'm angry, you know what I'm saying? Right? So, you know, when we can separate our identification of who we are from what we feel, feeling is much less likely to drive our decisions and be such a burden, really. So this is, you know, myself being someone who really held importance in feeling, I felt like I should let everybody know how I felt. It's important. Yeah, it's easy to laugh at because, yeah. So we get that idea, and then when the Buddha had a simile for this one, it was when in the autumn, I don't know if it's autumn, but after the hot season, or something, whatever climate we're in, those times when rain hits the water really hard and big bubbles pop up. And then what happens? They just burst so fast, right? That's feeling. It's kind of nice to have these images. So then when you're feeling really crummy, it's like, oh, it's going to be gone. Unless, of course, we keep it going with our thoughts. That's up to us. We realize that feeling just keeps changing and moving. But we can keep invigorating it by our thinking. So when we realize that, then we learn how to change our thinking. And the Buddha said, what we think frequently, that's what we become. So that training of the mind is so important. And then the next of the five khandhas is perception or memory. And the Buddha said that that's like a mirage. And the mirages I remember were when my family would go car camping. We did that a lot, like all over the country. The first camping trip was to Maine, from northwestern Indiana up to Maine, so it probably came through here somewhere. But, you know, going across the United States, you know, driving through someplace like Kansas, first of all, it feels like forever. But, or wherever, Nevada, you know, in the distance, everything's dry and everything's hot, but in the distance, you see this what looks like water, right, on the highway. The mirage. Any mirage, you get close to it and it's just not there. And that's the way perception is, the Buddha said. Certainly, you know, he'd ask those same questions for each khandha, you know. Is this impermanent? Is it suffering? Is it self? It's like, no, can't be. And then the next one is a mental activity, or sometimes it's called mental formations or volitional formations, because there's an element of will in the mental activity. And the Buddha talked about someone going out into the forest with an axe and wanting to get heartwood, you know, like the solid wood in the center of the tree, the really strong part. But he cuts down a banana tree, and you strip away the outside, and then you don't even, there's nothing in the core. I don't know if you've ever seen like a palm, he often refers to a palm stump. You know, like there's nothing in the core. It's just wrapped outside. And so that's the way thoughts are. There's nothing in the core. They just come and go. There's nothing abiding, dependable, substantial there. And the last one is consciousness. And the Buddha said that's like a magician's trick. And the picture he paints is at a crossroads, a magician sets up his table and he's doing tricks, and you know, it looks like it's something happened, but it's not really real. Well, it's consciousness. So this is sense consciousness. This is the consciousness that comes with the senses. And then, you know, when we think about the senses, the Buddha also did the same thing. Is this self? Is this, you know, everything we know through, you know, in the world comes through our senses. You know, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thought. And if it weren't for any of that, we wouldn't have any contact, no feeling. It's just that's how we experience the world. And the Buddha would say, okay, if we look at the eyes, are they permanent? Obviously not. So they're suffering. We want the eyes. I mean, right now my eyes are a little dry. So, you know, there's always something in the body. And, you know, so, and what we see also, everything we lay our eyes on, is also impermanent. Suffering. And this, can any of that be self? Can it be mine even? You know, it's like, and the Buddha will use this language like past, present, or future, interior or exterior, gross or subtle, in any whatever condition, whatever, you know, like whether it's that mountain, Mount St. Helens, you know, totally altered, not reliable, and certainly not self. And so the Buddha talks about the internal sense base, which is like the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. This is like the part that's part of our body, of our body-mind complex. That's the part that receives or processes that information. And then you've got the external thing, what the sights, the sounds, the smells, the flavors coming from whatever is producing the flavors, and what we feel. And then the thoughts, then the external component of this. And then there's a third requirement, the consciousness arises to make sense of whatever that is that's coming in. And when these three things come together, then the Buddha says we have contact, then we are aware, I am looking at you, or I am hearing this bell or whatever, right? And the contact is where feeling arises. So a lot of you know this. This is part of the chain of dependent origination, which I am going to talk about at another time, maybe tomorrow. But it's like, this is, the Buddha is pointing out that no matter where you look in any of this process, you have the contact and then you have feeling. And wherever you put your attention, you can identify that this is not self. It's nothing we can claim or think of as me or mine. So how do we use this? You know, and one I found what very valuable approach is to really think about how you think of yourself. What do you identify with? I had an experience a long time ago, and some of you may have had this kind of engaged in this kind of exercise where you sit with another person and that person keeps asking you, who are you? How many people have done this? Yeah. And this was part of a Qigong class that I was taking. And you know, at first, maybe what you say is, you know, I'm a software engineer, or whatever you do, right? I'm this or I'm that. I'm a mother. And then they keep asking, you know, like, you say, okay, I'm a Qigong practitioner or whatever, and then it's like, who are you? So you gotta dig deeper. And then you dig deeper, and it's, who are you? And then you dig deeper, and you just layer after layer, like, how do I identify myself? If someone meets me, what do I say about myself? What do I think I am? I'm this person who's grumpy. I have someone in my life who keeps telling us that they're grumpy and they laugh. It's like, no one believes you. I get that's how you feel. We're all very irritating to you. I get that. But it's so funny. And of course, they know, you know, it's just part of the whole, like, what experience of existing here in this body and this world, but it's not really a self. So when I was sitting with this other person and they kept asking me, who are you? Who are you? And all those layers of identity were being cast aside. What came up, you know, like from that intuitive space. So, you know, like when you really ask yourself a question you just wait for the answer to come up from, what is that, deep inside, somewhere else. Some people would call it the knowing. When the Buddha said, you know, when he got enlightened, then he knew and saw things that were not known before. This is like, where does that come from? The Thai Forest Masters call it the knowing. You know, like the Dhamma, you know, it's from that amazing reality, something we never thought of before, perhaps. Anyway, that's a really important practice, waiting for the answer to come. And then when that's a surprise, like I said, that's insight, right? It comes from truth some way. And what came for me that day was this image of a column of energy that ran through from the top of my head, from heaven to earth. And what came with it was the knowledge that this column of energy was the same for every living being. Well, you can't make sense of that from ordinary consciousness. That's when you kind of go into a state where you're just letting reality show up, right? So do that. Strip away all of the facade. All of the stuff you think you are. Set it aside. Identify it. There's no reason to feel anything positive or negative about it. There's nothing wrong with being a teacher or being a nurse or being a parent, or, you know, we have these roles and we do these jobs and we have this personality, this conditioning that causes us to be outgoing or reclusive or whatever it is. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not like there's anything bad about identifying with things. It's kind of how we get along in the world. But can we really know by direct experience that none of that is dependable, that that's not really a self? Because the problem with thinking this is me or mine is that it always brings suffering with it. If we have to hold up I'm like this and I'm, you know, like, it's suffering, it's a burden. We want to set it all aside. We don't have to carry that around. Even when we have a role, like if I'm here doing this, what I'm doing right now, as I'm the teacher, it's a burden. And it can't really come through just available like that. Does that make sense? Yeah. So don't become anything. And the things we've become already, just start putting that aside. We don't have to prove anything. We don't have to gain anything. And then we don't have to lose anything. We can just be present. We can be present in the moment. We can still plan. We can still create. We can still offer something to the world. We can be there for others and all of that. We can be, you know, develop those beautiful qualities, but we're not developing it as a self. Because as soon as we identify with it, we're screwed. It's suffering. And so this is the reflection for today. However you want to go about it. And we've already looked at impermanence, and we've looked at dukkha, and so that's really good support. So the Buddha took these topics in that order, I think, for a good reason. You know, so we can really start to let the perception of reality that we carry that wraps us up so much in suffering fall apart, so we can really see what's there, what's really there. Freedom, that's what's really there. Unlimited, boundless love, kindness, compassion, equanimity, that's what's really there. Peace. Questions? Okay, I think Joe was first. And then Molly.
My question is about ethical and crime.
About ethical
and crime.
Crime.
Rape, yeah. Sex abuse.
Yeah.
All these issues, they emerge. If you are not you, and you are not a self, or not, there is no. I'm not saying the way I understand it. Then yesterday is over. You are not what you are today.
Okay, this is important. I understand. I think where you're going, and this is exactly something that would happen. There was a group at the time of the Buddha who just believed that no matter what you did, it didn't matter. Yeah. They said, if you cut somebody's head off, you're just cutting through space. You know, it's no problem. But that's not correct. And that's why we have to think that of these two different levels. In conventional reality, the things we do make a huge difference. That karma that we make, like what we chanted last night, I am, I got it right here, the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever I do for good or ill, of that I'll be the heir. Hugely important. Because none of this unworldly, ultimate reality can be known from a place of doing these awful things, because it cuts off our ability to be present with that, to be open to that. When the karma is really strong, until we completely change and move away from that, we won't have good meditation. We can't settle the mind. And this stuff comes back to us. So that's why I said, you know, being killed isn't so bad. But being a killer, or can you imagine being someone who makes other people go and kill? This is horrible karma. And of course, what happens to us, it's also hard to put that down. We have to be able to be present with that trauma and work through it. Again, this is on the level of the worldly reality. We have to take care of that in order to have the mind be healthy enough and free enough to see this more ultimate reality. So it's not like it doesn't matter. And we should never feel bad about, you know, the way we're thinking, you know, like what we're feeling and all of that, but to begin to have the ability to be present with whatever we feel and work through it. So if we take the, you know, like there can be, this is spiritual bypassing. Oh, this happened to me, but it doesn't matter because, you know, feeling is all impermanent anyway. That doesn't work. It does not work. We have to turn towards it and be present with it and work through it. And we often need help to do that when there's some serious things that happen. So it's very important to keep those two levels in mind and to take care of ourselves and each other in this regard. Yeah, thank you. Molly?
Well, that's so useful. Thank you so much. The two levels. I have a story, and if it would be useful, I will tell it. I'm not entirely sure, but here it is. May I tell this story?
Please.
I'm going to tell it as it comes in. It's over 50 years ago. I'm in India. I'm in a satsang with Ram Dass and Neem Karoli Baba in a tiny little village called Kinshi. I am stripped. I'm a young mother with two children. I have come with a lover who I thought was my husband, who no longer communicates with me. I'm devastated. It's a tiny village, very primitive. I go to a temple to pray. I had thought when I came to India that I was going to do at that time what was the kind of conventional spiritual hippie thing to do, which was go to India and you do a pilgrimage and you go to a guru and he, you know, gives you Shaktipat and a name. Mm-hmm. And my guru died.
Your what?
The guru died.
The guru died, okay.
No name. I am coming up from that temple. I'm walking up a rise into a little village over a big rock. I'm on the left side, and coming towards me on the right side, there is this fearsome figure that I have never encountered and would never want to encounter. He's a sadhu, and he's covered in ash, and he's half naked except for loincloth, and his hair is matted, and he's got huge, luminous eyes. And he holds a trident, and he's about as scary and as fearsome a figure. Mm-hmm. But there's the path, and it's narrow, mm-hmm. and I have to pass him. And I've been weeping. I'm dressed in a sari with sandals. I have a, you know, tuck on my head. I'm a mess. We come up to this rise, and this creature turns to me, stops and turns to me, and he says to me with those huge eyes, "Who you?"
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at him and I said, "I don't know." And he kept those eyes on me and he said, "You, Sumitra." And walked away. There was my name. It means great friend. Huh. That's the story. I did try to use it in the world. I went to my local grocery store in little tiny Charlemont, Massachusetts, and said, "Hi, I'm back from India. I'm Sumitra." And they said, "Eh." So I named things for it. When you asked last night about, you know, who that, what that was, my psychologist person would have said it's one of my parts, the mm-hmm. wisdom person. Mm-hmm. It was Sumitra.
Hmm. Yeah, so we look at the value, you know. I'm more interested in what you did with being a single mom. Really?
Ask my children.
It's never easy. I've been there. Yeah. Thank you.
So this being seen is kind of a gift. Mm. And so thank you for helping us remember. And the responsibilities that you invite us to deeper invite relative to the moment-to-moment attention gives a pretty narrow gate for the continuation of that which we all are part of. My understanding of your story is evidence that this path is useful for the planet as well as for our listening capacity for whatever else is moving, and that these bodies of ours, such has been given for me, has been the place of every single emotion, maybe even there are more. And so this distinction making that the teachings offer, particularly in the khandhas and the similes and the magnificent ways in which we each learn to ground again, no matter where, no matter what, no matter how, the circumstance, it's helpful. It's just simply helpful. And so this cultivation of responsibility begins to be kind of the, I would say, cauldron, because something has to burn off first. Mm-hmm. And then the elemental quality of the cooling that comes forward when those more constraining qualities of mine, my particular opening now, as we navigate the distinction among the many paths that are available, right? Add a little technology to this and the ways in which we're listening in to this more fundamental root of the no self space is really the question that I've been holding around where to go, what to do, and the who am I? Mm-hmm. So those qualities of care and compassion and the ultimate choice when the other shows his, her, their face. I mean, we've had such a wonderful opportunity with that in such gross context here when it was so icy and stormy to come over to close the day. It was so powerful to me just as a, you know, little slice of time that, oh, it's all here. It's all here. So I wanted to just put words to that. From my no-self self that has a desire to further I don't know what it is, but there's something about the sharing of these moments of opening, and be they verbal or not verbal, really is kind of what I love, so that process of continuation, even when it's not understood, is followed, I guess is really kind of that in-between space where there might not be an opening yet. However, the individual practice can offer the capacity for that opening to further manifest. And that quality, in terms of my life, my circumstances, is multiple. So it's not a duality for me at all. It's many different contexts. And that's the kaleidoscopic quality of a settling process in my eighth decade of where and how and with whom might I further refine. So that's that responsibility, which cauldron do I wish to really, you know, get fully in? And so I'm grateful for the opportunity to kind of track a bit of advance contemplative practice for myself and whomever else I find myself listening with. Because it is a multiple process for me. It's not just a one thing, you know, as the story invites, that we are the many, and as we kind of ground in this new time, it's like exciting to learn how to make the right move. So that's kind of my shtick these days. And so grateful for the ways in which you offer. It's just back to the old truck, you know, hang out, keep it moving.
And the key is to really notice when we're experiencing dukkha, you know, through all of that, however it shows up. It's like the Buddha pointed at dukkha, which, you know, we use suffering as the English translation, but it's all the whole range of dissatisfaction and discomfort, and something just doesn't feel right, or, you know, it's like the whole, from the subtle to the very strong. And it's like the flag, it's the red flag. It's, you know, like, regardless of how we're thinking about it or what we're experiencing, when that dukkha is there, there's some work to do. Or there's some thing to discover. There's something to let go of. There's something we're holding, either by thinking it's mine, or this is who I am, or by somehow wanting to get rid of. And that's, you know, we can make it really simple. The simpler we make it, the easier it is to work with it. And then what comes from it is freedom, ease, ultimately nibbana. And that's, like I said before, that's a real purpose for this life, is to wake up. Yeah.
I have a question about an experience I had, and if this was an experience of not self or open awareness. I was in Nepal, and I was there on a medical mission, but also had the opportunity to have some teaching and meditation with a very soulful, enlightened monk. And we were meditating in Lumbini around the pool, where Buddha's mother stopped to rest and cool down. And it was just so, and at the end of the meditation, as the meditation progressed, I kind of lost any sense of a separate self. By the time it was over and opened my eyes, there was like, there was no skin, there was no me. I was just one with the water and the tree and the other people and the monk. Is that like an experience of not self or open awareness?
You know, it's interesting, you know, because that's one of the things that people experience, this kind of oneness with everything. I've had that experience also. Mm-hmm. And my sense of it is that it's a state that happens in the mind as a result of practice. Interesting, but not something to put too much mm-hmm. weight on, I would say. And how we label it doesn't matter very much, I think. So I think that it's really, you know, it's like, that's good. And, okay, let's keep going. Mm-hmm. I don't think it indicates any particular deep understanding of reality at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the deep understanding, the deep insights, they change your life. You're just not the same anymore. And that one, in my experience, was a nice thing to have happen. Mm-hmm. But there's more. More coming.
I just learned that there's four, I forget the teacher who said this, but there are four milestones of maturity in your practice. And the first one is interesting, unique experiences. Yeah. I mean, the most, and then it went on to true times of mindfulness, and then went on to noticing trends in your life. Mm-hmm. Think you are better. Mm-hmm. You're a nicer person, your relationships right. are better, and the last one is you're just practicing. But yeah, so I think this one might fall into that first one. Mm-hmm. Just fun, unique experiences.
Yeah, I think so, maybe.
A related question. I wonder how direct knowing of no self affects experience outside of the cushion, if you could talk about what that's like.
Yeah, the effect outside, off the cushion, the effect of a realization of non-self, even a small glimpse, any part of what we're laying down, we become... First of all, the ego is much decreased, to say the least. And what's interesting is that until that realization is complete, the ego keeps coming back. You know, you keep the becoming happens again and again. But to whatever degree that falls away, we're kinder, we're more loving, we're more available, we're less focused on getting what we want. There's less to want. We're able to be in situations that in the past would have been very upsetting or challenging, being calm and having much less worry about what's going to happen. Those are some of the things that are different. We're a lot easier to get along with. And we're a lot more able to read and see what other people need. Maybe too.
So this is an appreciation for the little book that you gave us. And that first section where you're talking about not killing animals. So I became a vegetarian 12 or 14 years ago. And many people choose that path for health, and I understand that. But for me, it was this sense of animals not being different from me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just, I'm very emotional thinking about that, talking about that, because as you were just saying about living with the sense of not self, I think it's just changed my attitude to everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just brought more love and more appreciation. This morning, as I was cleaning the bathroom downstairs, there was a tiny, tiny spider. And he'd gotten caught in the moisture.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to think how to rescue him. And I really did my best. I'm afraid I injured him. Mm. And I just... offered a little prayer.
Yeah.
Took him outside.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But all life is just so precious.
Mm-hmm.
So precious. So just really thank you for that reminder, and just encourage all of us to read that little book. It's lovely.
Thank you. Allie has something.
A question.
Allie has a question.
So, last night, and the epigenetic questions around how the not-self and our personal experience of the what has come through that might not be useful. And relative to contact in anticipation of deeper contemplation on this, I'd like some guidance for the distinction-making process of my own personal life as made very distinct from that which is not my history in this time that I've lived in this body, and the impressions that come that I'm beginning to have a different relationship with. And so, similar to the very exact experience with the spider, from these less visible or less digestible or metabolic sense of this, whatever that is, what might be some of the very concrete ways to meet at this encounter without, well, you know, being taken?
Yeah, so that it's pretty straightforward in that whatever arises, so whatever feeling arises, whatever experience there is in the present moment, you have your, you develop the skill of meeting it. So regardless of whether it's come through conditioning from past lives or epigenetics or whatever it is, it almost doesn't matter. Sometimes there's something that's very strong and recurring and implacable, seemingly, that we need to like do some therapy or do some kind of investigation or feeding your demons or whatever it is to work with it. But in general, what we want to do is be present with that experience, that feeling, and look at it as an object to us. So it's that idea of, okay, this is a feeling. It's not me, it's not mine, but this feeling is here, and maybe it has something I can learn from it. You know, like, you're standing waiting for an elevator and it opens and there's somebody in there and you're not comfortable, and then the feeling is telling you, just don't get in. It doesn't mean there's any danger, but just don't tempt any kind of problem, okay? Something like that. Fear can be informative, or some other thing that the emotion can help us understand something. But mostly, just want to be present with it. Being present with it and observe its changes and let it pass.
Yes, and is there, from this perspective of consilience, something that could be put to rest so that the power of those tendencies...
It gets put to rest a lot by being able to be present with it.
Just that.
Be present with it instead of caught up in it. When... It can be really intense sometimes, but if we determine not to act on it and we just observe it, hold it in that container, and we're present with it. And like I said, we can learn things, you know, like about our patterns, and learn how to let go of them, change them, to be more skillful, to be more conducive for the development of the mind.
So just to put this into reality for the story, this is a family matter. And so as I shift, it's quite interesting to understand how it also shifts those same patterns in my blood relatives.
Yeah.
So there's an additional sense of responsibility to do that contact and be touched and then apply the practices.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm appreciative.
Yeah, we can have some, you know, very kind of intense and often dysfunctional patterns in our close relationships. And then as we work through our part of it and we change in the way we react or interact, sometimes what happens is the person on the other side really freaks out. Things might get worse before they get better. But then if you stay steady with, you know, kindness, gentleness, and letting go as that intention, and you're aware of what your part is and you're not following that same pattern, then eventually it'll settle down on the other side too, to some degree. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Charles.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. I think we'll move on to the next adventure. We'll meet in the dining room. It's Dahlia, Chow, Joyce, and Molly. And we'll meet in the dining room. If anybody needs something out of the dining room, please get it as soon as possible so we get started. We're going to close all the doors. When the doors are open again, you can come back in. And I think that's probably all you need to know for now. And then at 2:00, we'll be back in here. And I'll be interested in knowing what you discover if you are up for sharing. So I hope you have a wonderful, productive morning.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.